This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is the production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We continue our series called A Summer Celebration of Women. Last week, we chatted with the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in Music, Ellen Taef Zwillich, back in 1983. This week, we'll speak with the 2019 winner of that prestigious award, and the fourth woman to be awarded the Pulitzer since 2013, composer and sound artist Ellen Reed. That name may be new to some of you, and when she won the Pulitzer Prize, many who follow classical, serious art music, call it what you will, were wondering why they'd not heard of her and her music. Though in one major city, Los Angeles, she is highly accomplished, being the first composer to have all four major classical music organizations, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Los Angeles Opera, the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and the Los Angeles Master Chorale, commission and premiere her works. You're listening to the opening minutes of her work titled Oscillations, 100 Years and Forever, commissioned by and performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra with chorus. The Pulitzer was given for her opera Prism, which deals with the aftermath of sexual assault and the psychological trauma which the victim must deal with. This sensitive and violent topic was presented through the libretto of Roxy Perkins and the music of my guest in a refreshing, intimate, and enveloping way. My guest and fellow composer and friend Missy Mazzoli, who will be my Cadenza guest next week, also run the Luna Composition Lab, a program to nurture, encourage, promote, and perform works by young composers who identify as female from the age 13 to 19, and it's anchored at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, and it is there that I chatted with Ellen Reed a few weeks back. Very happy to be here today with composer Ellen Reed. I guess if we start with the biggest news you've had in the last few months, I'll put my congratulations on that huge pile of congratulations, if I can, for winning the Pulitzer Prize. I've had a number of Pulitzer Prize winning composers on this program over the years, and it's always interesting their reaction. I don't know if you have enough distance from it yet, because there's the wow aspect of, I can't believe I won this, and of course there's the recognition that comes with it, the instant sort of clamor for your music and find out about you and all this kind of stuff. The downside's not really a downside, but it's just an interesting side, because then composers who've won it find people want to hear the piece you wrote for the Pulitzer duplicated. A lot of people now get in touch with you who never had the time of day for you before. So I'm just curious, like, you're kind of still in the little bubble, but I mean, how's it been so far?
Yeah, all those things are true. When I found out, I was super shocked. I was screaming, and my neighbor thought that someone had died, you know, and was texting me, is everything right. Okay? And then I went through a period of having all the energy, and I couldn't sleep. And then I could only sleep, and now I feel normal again, so I feel like I'm coming into equilibrium. I mean, the great news is if someone wants the music from Prism, I love that piece. It's a really meaningful piece. Sure. I worked really hard on it, and so I'm really happy to share it. And I think that there's a message it has to share, and the fact that it's reaching people at all is truly remarkable, and I'm still shocked that people are responding to it.
I don't know if they work at the same every year, but did you know you're on the finalist list? That they get? No, it's just...
It's all behind closed doors. I literally didn't know until friends were texting me anything. I didn't even know they were announcing it that day.
Okay. So I guess one thing that goes along with it, which is very cool, like I said, is this, there's sort of this clamor to find out about your music. We're sitting on a pretty nice, actually, summer day in New York City here. Your career has really taken off on the other coast. I mean, you're pretty well known in L.A. You got this, I don't know what they call it. I mean, it's the EGOT with the Emmy, Grammy. It's the quadruplet, whatever you had. You had all four major classical arts institutions in Los Angeles commission you and premiere your works. Mm-hmm. Which is the L.A. Phil, the Los Angeles Opera, the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and the Master Chorale.
Yeah.
So you went to the California Arts
Institute of the Arts.
Institute of the Arts.
CalArts.
So you're really well known out there. I guess is one of the upsides to all this is getting better known out this way and everywhere in between?
I think who knows.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows at this moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there still a push that you got to get, you know, I mean, we're so New York myopic out here. Do you have to be kind of accepted here as well?
I think it depends on where you are. You know, whatever your community is, that's the center of it. And so I don't think when you're in LA, it feels necessary. But when you're in New York, it feels necessary.
Do you find yourself better known in Los Angeles? I mean,
yeah,
just in general. I mean, it's
for
crazy.
Sure.
It's amazing.
It's, I don't even know if better known is how I would frame it, but it's a smaller community.
Right.
So I've worked with a wider percentage of people there, and I don't know if that's actually possible to do in some other scenes like New York where it's so saturated with ensembles that it's harder to get to know everybody because it's so many more people.
It's more of everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Times 10.
More of everything times 10, yeah.
The other thing that's really fascinating about you is you're in 14 years, you're the first, certainly the first composer I've had on this program who has nothing technically available on commercial recordings. All your music is on SoundCloud, and go listen to it, and there's excerpts from things and all kinds of things. Is that by choice? Is it just...
No, it's that hard to get things recorded.
It really is.
There have been recording projects that are set up to go, and then people pull the plug. I mean, it's been really challenging. But now that's like you're asking something that's changed, and that's one specific thing I can point to that is changing, which is great.
So we will hear more of your music now on recordings, whether they come out on hard discs or downloads or whatever.
Yeah,
but
totally. And actually, I'm coming right now from a recording session.
Good.
Yeah.
So right now, at least, the Fields has a lot of upside. I mean, it is. It's really great.
Yeah, I wonder if the downside is that then people have more opinions about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're less rooting for you, and they'll have opinions. But I don't know. We'll see. Jury's out.
The other thing is I have interviewed, you are now the third of four since 2013 women to win the Pulitzer Prize. I've had Caroline Shaw on, I've had Julia Wolf on. It's really great. I don't know if you see it as not a trend, but a turning of something that where they're not only are whomever taking women composers more seriously, they're being listened to more seriously. I mean, far gone are the days of Amy Beach when women were too dumb to compose, they had to perform. I mean, obviously that's a century, more than a century ago. How do you feel about that? You know, like I said, the cadenza before you was the first woman, Ellen Tafes Willick, in the 90s. It hasn't really been equal since the 90s. Let's put it on the table, you know. It hasn't been a 50-50 split.
Absolutely.
So how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, women are definitely still underrepresented in the field.
Yeah.
And I think at this very moment in the U.S., there are so many messages we're getting from the media about women. Like, I was orchestrating this piece during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and I think at this moment it is a statement to give the award to a woman.
Really?
I do. I think it is still very unequal in the field. And I think it's great, obviously it's great, that the award is seeing people like Duyun and Caroline Shaw and Julia Wolf, but in the field we're still majorly underrepresented.
Yeah. Is there any glimmer, is there any change of hope happening? I mean, I'm thinking more of just being listened to more seriously, if that's possible.
I do think that there is, well, obviously there's hope.
Yeah.
You know, hope, obviously. But also institutions are starting to make programming women more regular versus a one-off thing.
Yeah, a night of women composers.
Right, and then also the people who are interested in that music, who are interested in coming to nights of all female identifying composers, audience is widening as well. so that it feels like there's more interest in hearing what women have to say.
One of the goal lines would be that you don't really have to specify the gender of the composer.
I know. You would think.
Well, the thing is, I mean, these places, you know, if they're conservative or just trying to sell tickets, the minute they say they have a program including women composers, unless Clara Schumann and Fanny Mendelssohn are going to be on the program, they know it's going to have contemporary music of some nature.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even this year, a few months ago, somebody asked me for an orchestra piece or something like very basic, not even something crazy. And I sent it to them and they wrote back, "You're so accomplished for a young woman." Just like, what even does that mean for a normal? It wasn't a crazy thing. It was a really normal thing that composers do, you know? So I think that, you know, there's places like Kaufman Music Center, you know, New York Phil's curating 19 women over the next multiple years. You know, there are a lot of movement happening, but it's still something that we have to keep our finger on, because some people aren't with the program.
Yeah, and the creative side has its own weird, I mean, the female performers that have to have gone out over the decades where, you know, they read the review and there's more about their dress than there is the performance. But that's with the creative side, it's exactly what you said. It's like, boy, you're so accomplished for a composer. It's like, well, you know, you wouldn't say that to the 22-year-old anyway.
Right, yeah. All right. But that's why we have Luna Lab.
Which we will get to.
So we'll turn to an instrumental orchestral work by my guest composer Ellen Reed, the opening minutes of her Petra Corps, performed by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, an ensemble for which she is now artistic advisor and composer in residence. So we've talked about the Pulitzer Prize. The piece that won the Pulitzer Prize is a work, I don't think it's too strong to say a male composer would not have composed it, or
probably wouldn't have composed it. They certainly would have composed it from the context.
I mean, honestly, as far as the theme of sexual assault, it happens to men too.
It does.
And so I think that some specific men who have had situations like that could have written something with as much knowledge as our piece had.
And from the woman's point of view, I mean, both you and librettist Roxy Perkins wrote it from a knowledge of experience, and it is something that the way you approach it, one might think, well, put it this way, you started working on this before the Me Too movement showed up, before men who were very powerful in public, not all men, seeing who still sits in the White House, but many men have been taken to task and have had to at least publicly had something happen to them because of their actions. But this all started before that. You kind of ran into something that became really timely and very sensitive and very appropriate, which you must have. How'd you feel? As you saw things happening alongside the production of this and the writing of it and then finally the performance of it, you must have gone, wow, this is...
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of back to what we were talking about before with the widening audience. I felt like as we were writing the piece, it would have been a piece that was heard by a more limited number of people.
Right.
And as people in this country have gotten more comfortable with the dialogue, it's expanded to be a story not just about women, but a story about people.
Right.
Because that's what it is.
Can I ask you about some decisions you made about composing the piece?
Sure. Well, first of all, I remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know you got a lot going on, but well, maybe just talk about the genesis of the project for our listeners, source of the story. You wanted to take the young girl on the journey from, I guess, maybe a denial to acceptance. I don't know those terms thrown around,
yeah.
But that's really what happens.
Yeah.
Know? Talk about the whole genesis of it between you and Roxy. I mean,
yeah, I mean, we came at it from a lot of different directions, and I think that those different directions made it into the piece where the subject matter we were dealing with felt like an important thing that a lot of people in the country and in the world have to reckon with. And we were interested in exploring what that kind of an experience does to your brain and how you have to almost relearn to be in the world.
Yeah.
And the world, in a way, changes. So we wanted to take the audience into a world that then changed.
Right. Each of the three sections are vastly different from one another as the world changes for Bebe the young girl. The choice of just having two characters with actually a third character, Chroma, the chorus. But I mean, the choice, I mean, the second part sort of gives the audience what happened, but it's not in a kind of graphic newsreel type of fashion.
Right.
So, I mean, you probably thought, well, we don't need a lot of people there. Though you have four dancers that, I mean, let's go into a choice of two, only two real leads, the chorus, four dancers actually doing the action. Yeah, we'll get to the music and the orchestra. I'm just curious about the human live.
I don't know how to answer that except that that was the way it was.
Really?
We were interested in this dynamic between these two people, and then there was the internal life of Bebe expressed through the choir that went from kind of out of phase with her to something that was more unified over the course of the piece. Because one thing we're talking about is after an experience, I think many traumas is that you, in a way, are shattered. And that there are all these parts of you you have to kind of, this sounds super cheesy, but bring back together. And so, in a way, the voices of Chroma were these different parts of herself that she wasn't able to access
right.
because of the world that she was living in at that moment.
So then, to have her mother in it, you mean you needed the mother in it for kind of explanation of how... And
I think ultimately it's a piece about a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, this thing happened during the relationship, but it's a piece about a mother and a daughter, and it's a piece about conflicting ideas about what the world is. You know, it's a piece about their relationship as much as it is about what happens to them.
Right.
And you need that, or else there isn't much of a story, really.
Yeah.
You know, like...
and I guess the choice of how you made it unfold, meaning, okay, you've got your topic, and you know the topic is going to be a little bit of a hot button, an issue very sensitive for some audiences. I mean, you have a great performance. We work with Julian Walkner all the time, because we broadcast
He's
Trinity
brilliant.
Every week. He's
yeah.
brilliant. Busier than the Pope, but brilliant. I love Julian. So you knew the performers, you had the Trinity Choir, you had
yep.
your soloists who were amazing.
Yeah.
But you still wouldn't know how the audience would shift in their seats being confronted with this.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it was my job to almost shaman them through it and to create a lot of padding, yeah, like musical padding and other softness around it so that people could feel it in a way that was coded in storytelling and coded in music. So I didn't ever want the audience to feel like they were getting attacked. I wanted them to feel like they were along the ride with the music through the journey.
Was there ever a fear of then soft pedaling?
No.
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 You and Roxy were fine with, yeah, what she had put down.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you would...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when you first saw it performed live, any either anecdotes or just remembrances of what you felt the audience was going through? I mean, you knew what was happening, but the audience didn't.
Yeah, I mean, by that point that there was an audience, we had seen it many times with the prep and the dress and all those things getting ready for that. And I remember the moment that we found kind of what the most intense scene was going to be. That really stood out. I think both Roxy and I got teary, and that's always something for me. If I'm listening, if something clicks, I start to get teary-eyed. But after our final dress rehearsal, Christopher Kelsch, who runs LA Opera, and my friend Zachary Drucker, who are both amazing, brilliant humans, but in totally different worlds, both came to me and said, "That was great." And I knew if I had them, then there was a broad spectrum of people that this would speak to. And it made me really happy because I was hoping we were bringing in an audience from different points of view, different age ranges, and different aesthetics as far as art goes.
Yeah, but there's a breath to an audience too when you're sitting there and you don't, and you can sort of feel them collectively.
Yeah, but
do
I think
this,
but it for works. Me, when it's my piece, I just am like, oh god, is this over yet? I think time really changes in a way that is hard to feel. I mean, I notice if they're quiet, and I notice we did something in the beginning of Act Two where it kind of starts before people are ready for it, and people
right.
literally ran from the lobby to sit down, and that was great.
That was a good sign.
So my guest Ellen Reed's opera Prism, which won the Pulitzer Prize this year for music, deals with sexual assault and the aftermath of its psychological trauma. The opera has two main characters, a mother and daughter. It opens in the daughter's bedroom, bathed in blue light, as both characters try to come to grips with this life-changing violent event. Then it switches to a club where the mother took her daughter, and while carousing, left her daughter, and she was assaulted. The opera comes back to the bedroom to close, where reality and acceptance and realization have taken place. In addition to the two lead roles, there is a chorus, a quartet of dancers, and chamber orchestra. Here's an excerpt titled Lost in the Blue. The mother, Lume, is sung by Rebecca Jo Loeb. The daughter, Bibi, sung by Anna Schubert. Choir of Trinity Wall Street and Novus New York, all under the direction of Julian Wachner.
Talk about the music. I mean, if you read the critiques of Prism, they're almost to a T saying, you know, that not only that you had arrived, but the music is just so integral into making this piece work. So it's a chamber ensemble. It shows off your choral chops, which are, your choral music is really, really wonderful. And you get this sound.
And Trinity is great to write for. They can do anything.
They can do anything.
Yeah.
And so can the Master Chorale in LA. Yep. So you're surrounded by good choristers.
Yep.
Percussion is always a part of it. There's electronic music effects in here. And you get this kind of shimmer at times, which is so much up in the number of your works. Just thinking of the music you would portray, because there is a violent act occurs, even though it's not portray- I mean, like you said, you went to shaman into this, which is kind of the first half of the piece, right? Give or take. I mean, there's a, this Kermit Impressionistic haze going on.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And so everybody's like, oh, okay, it's this dynamic between this mother and this daughter. We don't really know what's going on yet. But then you've got to, well, take us through how you change the music. Twice in this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I love different styles of music, so it was really exciting to me that within the story we got to commit to different styles that really helped to bring the story to life. And the kind of limited palette of the first act, I wanted for people to think they knew where they were.
Right.
I wanted them to think that they were in a land that was pretty much tonal, but maybe not quite tonal. There wasn't much noise. It got loud sometimes, but it was never just noise or gritty or electronic. Like, all those things we saved until later. So that you thought you had bottomed out, but where you thought you bottomed out was nowhere near where you were going to bottom out.
Right.
And so that when we came into Act Two, which begins not in this impressionistic landscape, but with a fat club beat that's just like boom, 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 people know that there's maybe something that they weren't understanding, that intuitively, even though when you're watching the first half, you feel like something's not quite right.
Right.
But when you come back in Act Two, you're totally somewhere different. You know that something wasn't right.
And that also kind of parallels what Bibi's going through.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the whole piece is point of view from Bibi's point of view.
Right.
So the impressionism of the first act is showing her, like, safety in the world where she is, and kind of showing musically where those walls are, that
right.
there are a lot of things we're not hearing. And then as we get to Act Two, she's there in a club, in reality, which is something super different than we've seen before, and it's expressed musically and physically, and the set changes.
Yeah.
Everything kind of blows apart there, and from there, it feels like you can go anywhere.
Which, and then the third part, when she sort of comes to grips with, but, you know, has to accept this, the music is there's really no adjective for it. I don't know if you want to find an adjective for the music you've composed for the third part of it.
But yeah, I think it's the most new music-y.
Yeah, it's new music-y.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things happening.
A lot
of extended
noise.
Techniques
yeah,
on various
exactly.
instruments, so you know we're dealing in a sound world that can only come from a 21st century composer.
Yeah, and also I think when you're at that point of, she's so close to breaking, that to me you need extended techniques to get there. You need to feel like you're really on the limit of what the instrument can do, and that you're not in anything that can be expressed through tone.
Right.
You're somewhere that has to be expressed in a really different physical way, and you're able to see the players, and I think it hits you in a different way.
Last thing on Prism here, I want to get your words right. Music allows one to understand experience that's not yours.
I think it was like, it's the closest we can do.
Right, I get that, but sorry for the banal analogy, but think about the subject matter. I'm asking my listeners to think about what you were tackling subject matter-wise here. But if you think of, like, Richard Strauss, Strauss writes the Alpine Symphony. What does he want to do in his late romantic style? For those that can't get to the Alps, he's going to paint it in the music, and you're going to have an experience of going up to the top and seeing the world.
I love that.
But that's what you're doing, too.
Yeah.
But this is with a topic which is horrible for some people because they've had to deal with it personally. It's a topic a lot of people don't want to discuss. Takes into legalities and crime. I mean, all this is bundled up in this, and that's what you took on here, to say you need to have this experience. That's a pretty amazing thing.
Thank you. I mean, some of the best feedback I got was somebody just sent me a Facebook message that said I felt emotions I'd never felt before.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting for me.
So you keep saying that Prism is your first opera, but I'm confused if I look at your past output because there's things with tech. How does Prism fit in with what you've done before? Because your career really, I know you've been writing for a long time, but I mean, it's kind of not even 10 years that you've been writing where stuff has been sort of broken out into the wider public, whether it's a film score, whether it's a choral piece or chamber music. But I mean, you've got things like Hopscotch and Winter's Child.
I mean, they're operatic, absolutely. And they are operas, but they're not an opera at this at this scale.
Okay.
You know, they weren't. Hopscotch was an opera, but made with many other people.
Right.
And that was that was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And Prism is my first opera at this level.
Okay. And you see
but
it as a natural progression. It's a natural progression from what you've done?
What is natural progression? I don't know.
Well, it means that the pieces I did before, I needed to do those before I could do this.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, but also, like, I almost feel like each piece exists in its own world. I think maybe more than natural progression is that it was supposed to happen at different points. Prism was supposed to happen years earlier.
Right.
And that because it was moved and the way it was, when it landed was so perfect and so timely for it to be received well.
Right.
And so as far as like natural progression goes, I think it's more about when it was actually premiered. It was a time when people could hear it.
Okay.
Versus like, could the music have happened? I think if it had ever happened any earlier, people wouldn't have been able to hear it. So we wouldn't be talking about it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Even if every note on the page was the same.
Here's another excerpt from the opera Prism by my guest Ellen Reed that won the Pulitzer Prize for Music this year. This and the preceding excerpt, with the same singers, orchestra, chorus, and conductor, come from a new recording of the work on the Decca label. It has just been recorded, and the digital release will be in August, with the physical disc slated to be released in the first quarter of 2020. This excerpt is titled Run.
Run!
you have a very complex musical palette that you compose with, which is obvious in Prism, but I talk about the choral writing, the orchestral writing, the percussion writing, all this kind of stuff. But there's a lot of connected dots. You've had a lot of success in L.A., here we are in New York. You're born in Tennessee, and you didn't raised in a classical music family. Can you, like, connect the dots? I mean, you went to Columbia, you went to the California Institute, but how does this... most composers have this thing of, well, here's when I started creating. I started writing pieces at the age of five, and blah, 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 all this kind of story.
I loved music, and I think that's really connective for me. And I was able to be in music in a way where I wasn't told what music needs to be. And so I was able to appreciate a lot of different styles at an equal level that I think has come into my writing in a way that people find exciting. I didn't start writing music until I was at Columbia.
Okay.
And I started writing then, but I wasn't writing as part of my schooling. It was just something I was doing to kind of help feel better about being a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, and one of my professors heard it and said that was really good, and I was so shocked, and he kind of encouraged me to think about actually doing that, and it was so crazy to me that that would be something. I didn't know any composers. I definitely didn't know any female composers. I didn't meet a working female composer until I was 26.
Wow.
And then after undergrad, I went abroad to Thailand, and I think in the beginning of my career, I kept almost trying to do other things. I thought I would teach or be an admin and write, and then where, like, definitely at my core I wanted to write, but I just didn't know anybody who was doing that. And after teaching music in Thailand for a year, I did press releases at this incredible theater company that was doing Thai and Western fused operas from a Thai operatic tradition. And I dropped in a CD along with my, you know, can I just come and edit your press releases, please?
Right.
And the woman who ran the theater called me and was like, why don't you come be my music director? And so then I got this amazing opportunity to work with Thai musicians and learn about Thai classical opera and Thai classical composition, which is so wildly different from anything Western-based. And like from everything to what is a composition to what is a composer, like these very basic concepts are really different. And for me, it was very freeing where then so many things could be music.
Yeah.
And so I went to CalArts for my master's because it seemed like a place that could kind of hold space for all of these different types of music making.
Okay.
Am I connecting the dots?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm a little fuzzy. What was music for you in high school and stuff like that?
I played in the high school band.
Okay.
And played piano.
Okay.
And sang in a church choir.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah. So you were doing music.
I was doing music, but it wasn't at a like super professional level at all.
What about what was going in your ears as far as just influencing sound? I mean, your choral writing, you know, I hear some things, like the way Steve Reich will stack chords. I hear that in some of your choral writing. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but that's what starts. I mean, were you having things in your ears besides the Thai music, which is completely different?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I mean, I remember falling asleep and hearing music. So I think it was definitely a way that I was processing the world. But, you know, there were some outlets, but there weren't so many outlets. Okay. At that time. And so once there were more and more outlets, I began to be able to express myself more that way.
Well, it's interesting because I think that some of the, you know, you read the critic comments about some of your music, not even just Prism, but the word fresh comes in a lot, which could be a little euphemism back to the woman composer thing.
I'm always happy to be fresh.
I know that, but let's give them their due, and I think it's this kind of, I'm not really sure where this comes, because everybody likes to connect the dots and draw lines and network people up, but yeah, there is this sound that you have, which is... like I said, it's like, it's new. It's like, I can't really put a finger on it, which is good for a composer because it's your finger.
Right.
We've mentioned the Luna Composing Lab.
So that Luna Composition Lab.
Composition Lab, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So we're here at the Kauffman Music Center. This is where it's run. So it's you and composer Missy Mazzoli, and Missy will be a Cadenza guest in the coming weeks. What is this about? This is a workshop for composers that are female, identify as female, non-binary, non-gender specific. Talk about it.
Missy Mazzoli and I co-founded Luna Composition Lab 3 years ago. And it's a special program of the Kauffman Music Center. And in the years since we co-founded, it's really grown and it's been such a meaningful thing to be part of. We went from serving 3 fellows in New York City area to serving 5 fellows across the nation. And the program is comprised of basically bi-monthly lessons with working female composers in the field for the fellows throughout the school year. And then all of the fellows come to New York for a concert that features their music with Kaufman Music Center with Face the Music and some other New York-based ensembles. And they're also part of master classes. And this year, our master classes were out of this world. Yeah. They literally had master classes with Renee Fleming, Jennifer Coe, Rebecca Heller from ICE, Toyin Spellman-Diaz from Imani Winds, Julia Wolf. Wow. They met Peter Gelb, the general manager at the Met Opera, Paul Cremo, who's the Met's head dramaturg, and they attended a concert of Y Music, and Y Music had mentored to them through the year. So that through this program, they were able to meet these people that Missy and I have had to work so hard to kind of get into our world, and then immediately we're able to bring these 13 to 19-year-olds into the room with these people.
And when you guys started this, it was just the need to give these young female composers a foot in, a step in.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely addressing some pipeline issue.
Yeah.
And already our fellows are going to some really excellent schools. We're able to help them by writing letters of recommendation, by providing quality recordings of their concerts. And this year, International Contemporary Ensemble is recording all the pieces that the fellows wrote this year.
Right.
And with material like that, it's easier to be heard. It's kind of what you're asking me, is like, have I noticed that more people actually want to, you know who I am or anything? And I think by having this excellent material, a recording by ICE, a letter from Missy, are you kidding me? That's like definitely going to help them be heard as they go forward. And also, that's one part of it. And another huge part of it is connecting people to a group of composers and connecting them through their work. And each year, the Luna Lab Fellows have been in touch with each other and texting each other, and they know all about each other before they show up, and they stayed in touch. And it's been great getting the fellows from the three previous years into a room, and they meet each other, and it feels like they're not alone, you know, where some people are coming from places where they're not in a city like New York or like LA, where they're surrounded by people making music all the time.
Yeah, and they also might, depending on what they're going through in their life as far as their gender identity, you might be really outcast or
just alone.
And you're giving them a support group and all this kind of
stuff
to create. And we hope to have a Luna Lab concert, the 2019 edition, coming up on Celebrating Your Musical Future at the beginning of September to open our 10th season. Speaking of labels, real quick, look you up. Composer, sound artist.
Mm-hmm.
And some people might look and say, what's the diff? It's just curious.
I'm interested in making work that's outside of the concert hall. I'm interested in making sound installations.
Yeah.
And I worked with International Contemporary Ensemble and Opera Omaha to make a sound installation that's a playground that's built out of things that cause carbon pollution for children to play on.
Okay.
It's both very dark and beautiful. and I think for me, sound artist means about how the sound is heard, taking that into consideration, and breaking things outside of the concert hall.
So there's a big sound artist thing you're doing with Disney Hall. We'll talk about that in a second, right? Are you still doing it? Is it commissioned from Disney Hall? Has it been done?
With Janet Cardiff?
Yeah, that's been
done. It's up and
it's
running.
It's up and running. Okay,
and free to the public.
And
so
if you're in LA,
Janet Cardiff is the best.
Just to round back to where we started, you know, Pulitzer Prize, Prism. We talked about what Prism. Do you think you'll run into any creative avenues where people will expect you now, whatever work you produce, to take on topics as serious as what you took on in Prism? I mean, will you be able to lighten things up? I'm just thinking about like a Broadway composer as a hit, and then they expect everything to be, you know, think Hamilton, right? He's expected now to continue. I mean, have you gotten any vibes of people are feeling that, well, she's going to produce serious things about serious topics to our society?
Well, I mean, we can look
to her for.
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think the cool thing is now I have more agency in what I'm doing, and I'm interested in making things that are relevant.
Right.
And so to me, there are things that are relevant, like the climate crisis that I'm interested in writing about, or also, with the way, depending on how the world is, certain things take on relevancy or almost a political hint just because of what the world is doing.
Right.
Like, I've been thinking a lot about the Four Seasons. And if you make a work right now about the four seasons, it's actually political because they're changing,
right.
You know, and there are ways to frame things in the context of the world that changed the meaning.
Yeah.
So nobody's asked me to write another piece that has any particularly dark subject matter, but we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me it's more about relevance and more about, it has to be personal in a way. I mean, or work with people who it is personal.
From another opera project, one that preceded her Pulitzer Prize-winning Prism, here is an excerpt from Winter's Child, exploring a Southern Gothic horror story with a libretto by Amanda Jane Schenck and music by my guest today, Ellen Reed.
We didn't mention this word at the top, but it's a little bit of a cliched word, but you have a little cachet now where people are going to say, oh, we'd like to hear what you're going to be writing. So what are you writing? I know there's a piece for the New York Phil. What can you talk about?
Yeah, that way? Great.
Because some composers can't talk about certain things,
right.
Or they're superstitious about talking about.
What can you
talk about?
Yeah, well, I'm really, you know, happy to be part of New York Phil's Project 19 commissioning project, and I am on a concert with Renee Fleming and Bruckner that YAPA is conducting, which is very exciting, in late February. So it's about a 10-minute piece, and I have a draft of it, and it's a pretty bad draft right now, but I have time to get it to a better level.
It will include Renee's voice?
Nope.
No,
it's just for orchestra, but it's on a program with her. She is singing covers of Bjork,
so it's
pretty exciting. Yeah, I'm working on that, and I'm there are a bunch of projects that were kind of slowly starting to move pre-Pulitzer announcement that now we're kind of figuring out where they go. I'm also the artistic advisor to the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and I'm really glad to be working with them. I've worked with them before, and they're brilliant. They're great. And right now I'm working... I literally came from a recording session for a sound installation that will be up. It's an aria from Prism that we're going to do in surround sound with Los Angeles Opera.
Hmm.
So that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to the beach.
I'm not sure that translates into anything concerning sound, but you know.
Everything. Are you kidding? Yeah.
It's great what's happening in the world of opera. I mean, before we turned on, I told you I had Lisa Bielaba. She just did this serialized opera, which you can watch like a TV serial.
Yeah.
I had Chris Cerrone, who's in Brooklyn, not long ago, and he did the thing in Union Station, Los Angeles.
Yep.
So there's all these, like, virtual reality operas, things happening in a moment. And, I, you know, I was always scratching my head for years thinking, opera's the perfect vehicle for cable, internet, blasted stuff to take on. It's just perfect for it. Why isn't this happening? Why do we have to have a single shot of La Traviata from an opera? It's crazy.
Anyway. It is so ripe. It's everything.
Opera
is everything. And so it's a great storytelling medium. And, yeah, I'm really interested in all the different ways that opera
maybe
can
when
be.
You bring your group of Luna students in 3 or 4 years and they meet all those people you said, and they'll meet the head of the Metropolitan Opera. Maybe it'll be a woman. Maybe Peter will step down. Nothing against Peter, but maybe he'll step down. He's had enough years.
It's incredible. Two of our fellows this year had written operas.
Wow.
One of them, my fellow, who's amazing, she was 16. She wrote, produced, and she sang in her own opera. And she had done this before I met her. And another one of the fellows brought her CD of her opera and gave it to all the people that we had the master classes with.
That's great.
So, yeah.
We should say that you are a composer not yet 40, so there's a lot of years of creating coming from you, so we'll look forward to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting, because if you go look what you've composed, there isn't like, oh, well, she's going to write this next. You know, here comes the next string quartet. I don't know what you're going to write next.
Great.
That's good.
Yeah, I like exploring and trying different things. It keeps it fresh.
Keeps it fresh, the word of the hour. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking all my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat, like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk with, but could. When I you can get flooded with names sometimes. When I asked that, what was one name or the first name that popped into your head?
Oh, jeez.
I know. It's...
Well, I had two names, and one of them isn't past.
Well, but you then have a chance to
it's true.
Talk with them.
Yeah. The two names that came in at the same moment were Ravel and Bjork.
Okay.
So, Bjork? Maybe in the same room.
You got to use your cachet to go meet Bjork in the next year from winning the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
But Ravel, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I could see that.
I just heard he's such a unique personality and his music is so moving and just, overwhelming that I'm curious to know the person that came.
Yeah, and the color you have in your music is not Ravelian, but you care a lot about color and timbre, and you can tell. So, I mean, that's interesting. Yeah, Ravel isn't chosen often. I think once or twice over the last few
years. I just heard he gives people a glass of tea or like a cup of tea.
Yeah.
But then if you picked up the tea, there was actually no bottom in the teacup.
It was like a practical joke.
So yes, and then it would fall all over you. So I would just make sure to not pick up the teacup if I met Ravel.
You can use the napkin he wrote Bolero on to just wipe up the tea.
Yeah, right.
Final question is non-musical. You just mentioned something, but everybody interviewing Cadenza fills their life with music. You're going to have a very busy year ahead of you in a couple of years. But, I mean, when you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can take you away from composing, what do that's enjoyable?
There's so many things. I love being outside, so usually walk, jog, take the dog for a walk. Something that's so basic, that's so boring.
And you have, if you're in LA, you have your basic paths and haunts
and
places you go.
Yeah, all the parks. I love all the parks. I know like what time to get to them to have the best time. Yeah, it's a super important part of the routine.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's opposite. In LA, I'm all about the morning walks. And in New York, I'm all about the night walks.
Well, it's a city that doesn't sleep.
I know, it's really different.
LA doesn't either, but in a different way.
In a different way, morning in LA is magic, and night in New York is magic, so you get it all.
Ellen Reed, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Composer and sound artist Ellen Reed. You can find out more about her at her website, Ellen, E-L-L-E-N, Reed, R-E-I-D, music.com, ellenreedmusic.com. Again, the new Decca recording of her 2019 Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Prism, dealing with sexual assault and its traumatic aftermath, has been recorded, and the digital release is slated for next month in August, with the physical disc coming in the first quarter of 2020. Decca is part of the Universal Music Group, so you can keep tabs on this release by going to universalmusic.com. I'll leave you with Dreams of the New World, co-commissioned by the Los Angeles Master Chorale and Trinity Wall Street. This is the premier performance from Disney Hall in Los Angeles, conducted by Grant Gershon, director of the Los Angeles Master Chorale. It sets a libretto by Sarah Labrie. We'll hear the section Los Angeles 2018 Experience. Music by my guest today, Ellen Reed. My summer celebration of women continues next week as I'll speak with Ellen's friend and co-founder of the Luna Composition Lab for young female composers, the very accomplished composer Missy Mazzoli. And as always, I'm glad you are in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.